would like to say a special thank you to Pfizer Healthcare Ireland for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you.
This week on the podcast, we are thrilled to be joined by Anya, who has kindly offered to share her story and speak with us about her experience of getting diagnosed with breast cancer in her early 30s. Anya explains her initial journey to getting diagnosed and the multiple treatments she has had ever since. We hear about the moment that she met the love of her life, Ed, and despite undergoing treatment and the COVID-19 pandemic, they had the perfect wedding. Anya explains the incredible role that friends, family and supportive work colleagues play and the importance of asking for help. We are so grateful to Anya for having us to her beautiful family home in Mayo and bravely sharing her story. Thank you, Anya.
Welcome to the podcast, Anya. Thanks so much for having us in this gorgeous house down in Ballina. Yeah. We're not really in Ballina, though. We're in
Crossmolina.
Yeah, I knew straight away I got that wrong. But we're just delighted to be here. And we're really privileged to be here, to be honest. We were initially connected through Instagram and we think your story is an important story to tell. So we're delighted to be able to do that today. So I suppose we might kind of go back to the beginning where everything started, back to where it all began. And I suppose maybe firstly, you could just tell us who you are and before all this began, who you were maybe, that might be a nice place to start.
So before all of this began, I was very, very busy. I've always been a really active, busy person, going here, going there, lots of different friends all over the country, flying over and back to England to meet friends that I made when I lived there, just always on the go and always catching up with people. I wouldn't have been a person who was able to sit down at all, just always something happening.
Which is not uncommon actually, isn't it? Like at our age, we're all very similar ages, there's a lot happening. You don't really take a second sometimes to stop and pause and digest.
And I'm a primary school teacher and I've been teaching for the last 15 years and I absolutely love my job. And as I've said before, like, I love teaching. You go in and you just don't think about anything for the day because you're so busy. I'm sure you can relate to
nursing. When you're a teacher, it's kind of part of your identity, isn't it? It's such an important part of your life.
And kids have a way of making you not think about yourself because it's all about them, isn't it?
Their problems are way bigger than mine.
Exactly. So I suppose we know that the part of the story that we're going to tell today started in 2016, where you would have been fully fledged teaching and busy and all around the country and that, but you developed a couple of symptoms at that time. Is that right? Maybe we might start.
So, like, I didn't get my diagnosis until October, but when you look back, there was lots of signs, but I was only 31. You don't really expect something like this to happen at 31. And when I look back, I can see, like, so I finished that school year teaching and it was the 25th of June we got the holidays. And then I went to a wedding the day afterwards. It was down in the lodge at Ashford and I was so tired. Like, I was like, I have to go. Like, I'm just so tired.
And that wasn't like you at all.
That wasn't like me at all. But then I was like, busy year, end of school year, there's an awful lot going on. And then I put it down to that.
Of course.
And I think back on another night then, the festival was going on in Crossmolina. And again, I was just so tired. That was the first thing, really.
Fatigue and tiredness.
So if I was to put a date on when I got it, it was long before I got my diagnosis.
So when you say you were fatigued and tired, did you do anything, I suppose, to try and, I suppose, relieve the tiredness? Or did you just say, Grant, I'm tired, I'll just rest and continue?
All I did was, like, sleep when I could.
Yeah, of course.
But it was still there. But, like, that summer, just was just crazy. Like, I was at hens, weddings, going from a hen to another wedding. It was just wheeling the suitcase in and wheeling the suitcase out.
So you had a reason to be tired
I had a reason to be tired,
So then I suppose what prompted you to get to the GP then? Because if...
So it was at the start of the summer that I started getting visual migraines. And they'd be very bad, like you couldn't be driving in them. So I'd, you know, if I was coming from down the country at a hen or a wedding, I'd just pull in and take like a Nurofen or a Panadol and just kind of snooze for a little while to let the visual migraine go. So I was like, I need to get this sorted out. So I went to my GP who... Well, I've since moved GPs because I live in Castlereagh now. But my GP at the time was lovely. And she was like, it sounds like it could be like hormone related or whatever. And she said, we'll take you off your contraceptive pill. And I came off that and the visual migraines went. So I was like, well, that's great. That's sorted. Off I go.
Sorted kind of thing. So then obviously things didn't completely sort itself. I suppose what popped up next for you then?
So it was a very busy summer and I was just very, very tired the whole time. But then the next time I went to the GP was that I had had, the rash was the second thing.
You mentioned some pains.
There was this kind of a stabbing pain here. And I went to the GP's.
So kind of in your right side of your chest, kind
there,
of, was it?
Yeah. There. And I went to the GP and my GP was off on maternity leave, but it was a practice with four GPs. So I was like, I don't mind seeing somebody else or whatever. And she was like, oh, you've probably just pulled something. It's fine. And I went off again. And then... then I went back into her, with the rash. And then they thought that was mastitis.
So you developed a rash on your both of the breasts.
Both of them,
yeah.
And they thought that was mastitis. And they put me on flucloxacillin.
And you'd never breastfed or anything like that, no?
No. And then I went back in again because I had had I was like had problems with my lungs and I was coughing and coughing and coughing.
You mentioned a taxi man even said it to you.
Jeez, you'd want to get that cough sorted out. And I was like, okay, it must be really bad now when somebody's commenting on it.
And could you notice how bad the cough was yourself or were you used to it?
It was so bad. Wow. It was so, so bad. So as I said in the email, we were at the All-Ireland, just like the first All-Ireland, then we had a replay and it was a miserable day and then that just kind of finished me off altogether.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And when I went into the GPs again, I saw another GP, so I did see the four GPs in that practice, which is, it gives me relief because it wasn't that I was going back to the same one, like four GPs saw me. And then they put me on an antibiotic because they thought I had a chest infection.
And this probably at this stage, this was your third or fourth time going back to the GP with something relatively new each time.
And would this would have brought us up towards the end of the summer at this point, would it have?
That replay of the All Ireland was very late. It was the 1st of October. Then I went into school then that following week and I was just, I had to have hall scissors in my mouth. I couldn't stop coughing. And, you know, I had gone into them on the Monday after the All-Ireland, which would have been like the 3rd of October, say. And I did that week at school. And then the following Monday morning, I couldn't eat my breakfast and I had to lie down on the couch, went to school, did the day at school again, and then I was like, I have to go back in like this. I knew myself there was something awfully wrong. And when I went back in, my original GP was back from maternity leave, and the minute she saw me, she just picked up the phone and told me to go straight to A&E.
Well done for consistently going back.
Yeah,
yeah, you did everything right.
So difficult when somebody, as you said, different doctors as well are saying it's fine, it's this, it's that, you're busy. It's so easy to brush it off, but you consistently went back on your fair play, because there's a lot of people, and possibly including myself, would just put it aside and go.
But like, I've never been sick. Like, when I rang up about my sick leave, they couldn't find me because I'd never taken a sick day in all them years.
Yeah, so you knew something wasn't right. Your body was saying you need to get this sorted. Yeah. Kind
of, but you know, like when you're not, maybe as nurses you would know, but when you're not in the swing of things, you just go to your GP and they tell you what to do. Mm. Like if I had known now what I know then, I would have gone straight to A&E.
Of course.
Months before that.
Yeah, but like you say, you know, like it's not when you're 31.
Yeah,
you're not thinking the worst case scenario all at that point, you know, and none of us do, like, you know, and especially because your symptoms were quite unusual, it wouldn't be something you'd pinpoint to say, oh, that's what that is, you know, that way. So, it's and that's why I think this conversation is so important, because obviously there's the general kind of signs and symptoms that everybody looks out for, but actually your case is completely different, and that's why it's like, really important.
And I had managed to do like so much, even like if you see that picture of my sister on her wedding day up there, that was taken in August before this. Like I obviously had breast cancer that I had traveled to the liver and lungs at that stage, and you wouldn't have known.
You had the picture of health in that picture.
So I suppose to kind of recap on everything, your symptoms actually were mainly, it was a fatigue, you were getting a stabbing pain in your right chest.
Yeah, that only happened when I started back in school in September.
Yeah.
So that was the pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was fatigue first.
Yeah.
Then stabbing pain, just near the collarbone there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I had the rash.
The rash, the mastitis, and you got antibiotics for.
And then I had the cough and couldn't breathe.
Yeah. And then early on, you had the visual migraines. And they resolved after you come off the pill.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was all between June to October. So very short space of time to be. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So that brings us up to October when your GP picked up the phone and told you to go to A&E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had planned to go into the GP and then run off to get a handbag for Louise's wedding. And then I was like, I'm not going to make it up the street. And I just rang my mum and I told her. And mum came in to get me and we went straight to Castlebar.
Mm.
And my mum is very, like, she would worry a lot. It's just in her nature.
Mm-hmm.
She said it never entered her mind that it could be that because
of course.
I was so young and I was so active and I was so healthy looking.
Yeah, of course.
That's what shocked everybody.
Like you said, you're running around around the country.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So you went to A&E.
We went to A&E.
Yeah.
We were there for a little while.
Yeah.
The usual.
And then like, doctors started saying things like, "Oh, we're testing for this, testing for that. Might be TB, might be HIV, all this sort of stuff." They didn't even mention cancer.
Yeah. Like,
this was what the weird thing was.
Mm.
And then, like, doctors were coming saying, "Have you had a baby?"
Mm-hmm.
No.
And then can't confirm I definitely have had a baby.
And they're like, "And you haven't been breastfeeding?" I'm like, "No, I don't have remembered now. I've had a baby." No.
Yeah.
But, like, so that just goes to show how it wasn't very obvious.
It wasn't on anyone's radar.
It wasn't on anyone's radar, really.
No. It is really uncommon for someone to present with breast cancer in these ways, you know, that way. So,
yeah.
And I think you had asked earlier on before we hit record, but at this point there had been no lump, you'd never felt anything, no reason other than probably the mastitis to really do a breast exam. There was no indication.
No.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And you'd mentioned that there's not a huge history of breast cancer in the family.
Because I have said before about my grandmother, and people have said, no, that's not.
Because I do find still people do say, "Oh, well, sure, it's not in my family. I wouldn't get breast cancer, it's not in my family," or any type of cancer, you know. Yeah. Even my family would say, "Oh, it's not in the family," or whatever. Yeah. But actually, it doesn't need to be in the family at all. Yeah. So anyway, they ruled out TB, they ruled out HIV and pregnancy and all that.
And then I was in the hospital then, like in an isolated room, because they thought I did have something.
Yeah.
And I was in an isolated room until the 19th when I got diagnosed.
Okay.
But when I was in the isolated room, I was just so happy to be in bed. I was so tired. Like, that was my main focus. I was just so tired. And, like, all my friends were coming to visit me that week, and I was enjoying, like, Castlebar's food is very good. Like, they had nice food, and I was just resting and stuff. But then, like, they said this nurse in to talk to me about breast cancer and stuff, and then I knew that. And then I was just praying that it was just in the rest.
Yes, of course.
And then I went down for a biopsy. And then somebody was, talking about the sharp pain that I had, that was linked to the liver. And I was just like, oh my God, like, that how it could be so silent. For so long.
And it was the 19th of October that you got your official diagnosis. And that diagnosis was breast cancer that was in the lung and the liver. Is that right? Wow. I can't imagine how shocking that must have been.
After all those months.
And then you start reflecting on everything. And you're like, oh my God. But I don't see what else I could have done. Like,
there's nothing.
Absolutely nothing
you could have done.
No,
you did everything.
She did more than most people would.
Yeah, you did everything right.
Yeah.
So then it was, you were on this journey then of treatment, I suppose.
But like, I hadn't a clue, and I understand, because people just say kind of daft things to me. Because I just thought you get cancer and you get better, or you get cancer and you die. I didn't realize there was so many people walking around with stage 4 cancer, which there are. Living full lives.
Absolutely.
I just thought I'd do the 6 months of chemo and then everything would be fine and then I'd go back to normal.
And this was October 2016,
yeah.
And the first plan was for, so you mentioned to us it was what we call HER2 positive breast cancer. So normally it's a chemotherapy and a drug, Herceptin and pertuzumab. Sounds right. How did you find the chemo?
There was a pattern. Like, the first week I was just awful bad, like getting sick, very like busy in and out of the toilet. And I always left the first week like I wouldn't do anything. And then the second week I'd be all right. You know, if somebody wanted to come visit and they could only come that week, it'd be fine. And then the third week I'd be like, nothing was wrong with me at all. I'd be out and about, going for afternoon tea, meeting up with everyone. Ed and I would go away for the weekend or whatever. So it was grand because when I look back at that time, there was a lot of nice things because I spent so much time with everyone that is close.
You love.
Everyone I love.
There's something about getting horrendous news that does make you kind of have blinkers on for the people that are really important. They really just come to the forefront of everything, don't they? And I suppose Ed being one of the most important ones to you, isn't he? I think myself and Michelle, we were nearly hoping he was going to be here because the way you spoke about him in your email, I got really choked up reading it because, he just seems like such, as you do as well. We know you are, we're sitting here with you, but he seems like a really special person. Seems like he has been through everything.
He's been amazing.
Like. When did you meet him, I suppose?
So I met him on a random night in Westport. Myself and my friend Michelle were like, at Christmas time, we're like, we need to go somewhere else. And then we said we'd go to Westport during January, just a short in January. And then I was like, we won't go the first weekend, we'll go the second weekend because there'll be a bit of buzz around or whatever. And then the week leading up to it was like frost everywhere. Don't go out on the road unless it's life or death. And then we were like, we're going to Westport. And it took us like 2 hours to drive to Westport, and it should only take 40 minutes.
I was going to say.
And we went out, and then there wasn't that many people out. And then I was like, oh, what a waste or whatever. And then Ed and his friends, well, Ed was actually trying to finish a series, and then his two friends got onto him, come on, we'll go to Westport because they were bored or whatever. And Ed was like, no, I really don't want to. And then they all decided. So there was three of them, and they booked a room in Westport and drove over in the bad weather as well.
I was going to say, like, what are the chances that the two groups made those decisions in that weather to go to Westport?
Like, Ed had never been in Westport in his life.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And we were standing in the porterhouse. We were at the back of the porterhouse. Mm. And I could see Ed. Now, he tells a different story, but
He's not here, so it's not the truth.
Yeah, exactly. I could see him looking over. And he came over then, and I was like, look, I know you're really young, so I'm not that interested.
Yeah.
And then he started filling me with lies.
Yeah.
And he was 24 at the time, and I had just gone 30. So there's 5.5 years between us.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, no, everyone is always telling me how young I look. It's only because I shaved today. I'm actually 29. And then I was like, all right, okay. Maybe he does look.
We could deal with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at the end of the night, when myself and my friend Michelle were going home, he was like, I'm actually 24. So. I knew it.
He put the groundwork in at that stage.
Oh, yeah. He had told somebody else at that stage. But anyway, that's where we met. And he took my number that night. And me being so busy, I was busy the following week. And then he was like, this was the last time I was going to ask you out. And it was Valentine's night. And he said, are you busy this weekend? And I said, no. And we had our first date on Valentine's night.
Really? Oh,
gosh. Yeah.
It's so lovely to hear, because it's not that common that people put in that graft consistently, you know. He definitely knew what he wanted. He knew what was there. Yeah, exactly.
Now, and he tells a different story, since I was giving him the eye, which I wasn't. I was like, I am sick of young fellas.
I'd love to hear
this is the story that's getting published, and this is the truth.
Yeah.
It's out there now.
Yeah.
And this was February, your first date of 2016 as well, is it?
No, 2015.
Excuse me.
So we were together a year 9 months when I got diagnosed.
So you were obviously a fully formed relationship and everything at that point. That must have been difficult, I suppose, to try and navigate at that point, because you're still fairly new, I suppose, in a relationship.
Very difficult. Well, I never felt anything, only support from everyone around me. Like, even though Ed is young, if you met him now, he's very old-fashioned, and people always think he's older than he is. Nobody ever would have questioned that there was an age gap between us. And if they did, they'd think Ed was older than me.
Even the way you spoke, I'm surprised to hear that he's younger, because even the way you spoke about him, he just seemed like a very mature
mature. And like, he was just so strong. And like, my mum says that when we got the news that day, there was loads of family in the room. The room was massive. And mum and dad just went outside, and Ed just went outside the room, and, you know, they just tried to get themselves back together. And then they came back in. But, like, it must have been an awful shock, but he never showed that to me.
And it's so important for you to have that stability and have that support. See him being really strong for you. But I suppose that's testament to, like, obviously we've met your gorgeous mom and dad here today. It's just lovely for all three of them to have had each other. But you see that, being able to see them as really strong through all of this. It's important for you.
Unbelievable. Like, my mom is so strong, and like, you know, it upsets her because she has seen her mother go through that. And dad is just he's so positive. He's so positive all the time. He's great.
And, you know, it's nice to have a bit of a balance of both kind of energies, isn't it? You know, you do need that positivity, and then you need obviously a little bit of the other side of it as well. Like, you know, but I think people definitely feed off your energy as well. You know, your strength is just like vibrates off you as well. Even in your email you could feel it. So I'd say they get a lot of that from your energy as well, you know.
Well, like, I always think, like, people are like, oh, are you putting it on or whatever? But I can't. Like, if I'm sad, I have to be sad. And if I'm fine, I am usually fine, because nobody knows what tomorrow, if tomorrow will come at all. Why would you spend your time being miserable? So I am usually just quite happy and positive. And then, like, every time something happens, I just adapt and move on, and adapt and move on, and that just seems to be how I cope.
Which is special.
Yeah,
I don't know if you realize that, but it is a not, I would say, an unusual skill, but it's a difficult thing to do, especially when you're faced with as many challenges as you have been. So it's amazing.
Absolutely. And I suppose so that brings us up to, so you finished your first round of chemo. So you had 6 months of chemo.
I finished my 6 months of chemo on the 31st of March, 2017. And I was like, great, my hair will go back. Life will go back to normal. I was just so naive. I didn't realise that.
But you say you were naive, but when you got your diagnosis, was there, did they discuss that there would be multiple lines of treatment, or what way was it kind of explained?
No, it wasn't like, they just said, this is what we're doing now. And it wasn't until I came close to the end of my 6 months chemo that my oncologist was like, so you're going to have to be on Herceptin and Pertuzumab for the foreseeable. And you'll have to get it every 3 weeks. And then straight away I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And I'm in school and like just been ridiculous. Like always thinking about school and always thinking about just being normal. And I was like, every 3 weeks I'll have to come off, you know. And but then sure, I used to love going up because I'd go get my treatment and then I'd go to TK Maxx and it just became a little
it was a new routine. And then, so that was 2017. So you finished your, it was a year of Herceptin Pertuzumab, was it? Or was it continuous three
so weekly? I started on, so the Herceptin and the Pertuzumab, I was on that while I was on the chemo. And then I started it just after I finished the chemo, every 3 weeks I got Herceptin and Pertuzumab.
And I presume you were having regular scans then after every cycle and stuff like that. So things were kind of okay for a while, were they? Things were stable and the treatment was kind of keeping things at bay.
Exactly, yeah.
And and then I suppose, did you get married in 2017 or was it the fall, was it later
on?
No,
we didn't get married. We were meant to get married in 2020.
2020, sorry, I'm a bit behind or early.
And we were meant to get married the August bank holiday of 2020. But then with COVID, we were like, sure, it'll be all gone and over in a year. Yeah, so we just put it out for a year because everyone was doing that. So then we set our new date for the 25th of July, 2021. And we said, if there's only six of us there, we're still going ahead that day. And we had 50.
Brilliant.
Fab.
It was lovely. So there was so much chopping and changing during COVID, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah.
It's just one day you could have 15, the next weekend you could have four, then you could have
200 and then you were back to three. It was just such an unpredictable time, wasn't it?
And
I'd love to talk about the proposal and everything that happened with Ed. So to take us up to that point then, so in between, so you finished the Herceptin and the Pertuzumab, is that fair? And did you have any time at all?
No, I was taking the Herceptin and the Pertuzumab every 3 weeks.
Continuously. And then I suppose, did something change that they realised something had progressed or something had happened? Was there any symptoms?
So that year when I was sick, like Ed and I obviously got very close that year. And we started talking about a move. And then just by pure fate again, like I never ever go on the teaching site where you look for jobs because I already had a job. But then I just went on one day and there was a job in a school in Castlereagh. And that was at the time when it was very difficult to get teaching jobs.
And for all us dubs, that's in Roscommon.
Castlereagh in Roscommon. And I rang Ed and I said, oh my God, will I go for it? Basically, I proposed to him first because I was like, you know, if I move to Castlereagh, like, I'm not coming back. And he was like, yeah, go for it. And I got the job. And I was thrilled. It was in a lovely big school. The minute I walked in, like, it's just so fabulous. And the principal is just amazing. And I got the job as junior infant teacher. And I love infants. They're my favourite.
Really? Wow, I would have thought they'd be one of the more challenging.
Yeah, but they are in, but they're so so much fun.
So fun,
and they come in and they literally don't know where anything is. They're like, "Is that my arm? I need to go to the toilet. I miss my nanny." And then at the end of the year, they're able to read. Like it's the biggest,
amazing.
It's just
you really see the transformation throughout the year.
So, I started teaching there then in September 2017 and I was just so happy to be back in school. Everything was normal. And then I got a rash back on my left breast and obviously told my oncologist and they said, well, I got scanned or whatever, and they said it was just like some cancer cells that had escaped the chemo net, basically.
Okay, so it was in the skin, kind of, was it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I had radiation to my left breast November and December.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go up to Galway after school in the evenings.
For the radiotherapy?
Yeah.
So you were working the whole way through?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How did you find the radiotherapy? Did you have any side effects?
No, it was fine.
Mm.
Bit tired, but...
Yeah, that travelling as well is so tiring. It's every day.
I had a lot of people who were very good to me at that time. Yeah. They would drive me up, like Ed's mother. She's a nurse as well. So it's really helpful, yeah. Mm. And no, lots of people came and helped me drive up because I was determined to stay at school.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then that resolved itself. Mm-hmm. Now, my left breast has been tender, like very kind of sore, really, for the last, it's only in the last year, I'd say, that the pain kind of went.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fine. And then I was like, great, it's all under control now. That was just a little mishap. We'll move on. Yeah. And it was coming to the end of the school year there with the junior infants. So that would have been like May 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed when I'd sit down, it was like there was a weight on my head. And then if I stood up, it'd go. And I remember I was going to this festival with Ed and my brother Rory and my sister Siobhan and their kids. Ishnock is this kind of festival they have in May.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fine that weekend and I was telling Siobhan about it. And then I was like, yeah, I had this weird headache, but it's gone now. Then I went to school on the Monday. And every time I sat down, I could feel it again, like this really, really strong pressure on my head. So I rang the oncology team and they were like, get up here straight away.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm in school. And they were like, we don't care.
Yeah.
Get up here straight away.
Yeah.
So I had the brain scan and then they told me that I had to go straight to Galway for radiation.
Mm.
And I met my oncologist there and we have a really good relationship. He's just fantastic. He's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said to him straight away, because I remember him saying to me when he gave me my diagnosis at the start, it's in your breast, it's in your liver, and it's in your lungs. We're lucky it's not in your brain.
Okay.
Yeah. And I remember him saying that. And then when I was sent to Galway to meet him, I just said, is this it? Like, is this the end? And he was like, no.
Yeah.
So I was so happy then because... When I got that news, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So I was put on steroids and I had radiation to my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
It's a scary one actually, isn't it? Because you have the kind of mask on your head.
Absolutely, it's horrendous. Awful.
You can't move an inch.
Like this
metal, it's awful.
Mask on your head and you're like pinned to a slab.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like... You wouldn't do it to a hamster. Like it was just absolutely shocking.
It is, yeah.
But then I had, like, I'm very sensitive to every drug I take, which is wonderful because I usually have a good reaction.
Response to it, yeah.
But, like,
yeah,
it really impacted my mind.
Of course it did.
I was gone.
Mm, of course it did.
Cooking.
Yeah.
So it was very scary for everyone because everyone was like, is she going to come back?
Yeah.
And I was away, absolutely away with the fairies. Like,
wow.
It was awful. Mm. Like, awful.
I can only imagine.
Awful hard for my family and my friends and, you know, everyone was very, very worried at that time.
Yeah, it's a very scary time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that coupled with steroids as well is very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, not being able to sleep.
Yeah.
Your body image completely changing. It's very difficult on top of everything else that you're already going
through. Which is a part of it maybe that's not talked about an awful lot, you know.
Yeah. Shocking.
Yeah. They work wonders, the steroids, but they have some awful side effects for people. We see it all the time. But they have an amazing... effect as well.
I know it's
weighing everything up.
So I had the radiation to the brain and I lost my hair again.
Okay.
And then that was in May, and the summer then was spent in bed, literally. I remember that summer because we were renting a little house in Castlereagh, and you know, you could hear the music and stuff. It was just a fabulous summer as well. So I just spent the summer in bed asleep, basically.
And that's so unlike you, obviously.
So unlike me, yeah. And said. With the steroids, I just looked so different and everything. Yeah. But I returned to school that September and then I started work in the ASD unit.
And were the school supportive when you were called back?
Yeah. So supportive, unbelievable. Like, my principal and my vice principal has retired since, but like, she's a great friend and just so supportive.
Mm. Thank God, because not everybody has that, unfortunately. Yeah. Mm. You know, and I'm so glad they were, because there's two times in this conversation so far I've noticed your face totally light up. One when you're talking about teaching and the other when you're talking about Ed.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad that they were able to support you.
To see,
returning to work,
you can
and
see
how
your passion
it is.
For it.
So I had the full school year there in the ASD unit, and like, the ASD unit is autism spectrum disorder. Mm-hmm. ASD, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had never worked in a school that had an autism unit or anything. So I learned so much that year. Mm-hmm. And it was a great year. And I did September to June.
Mm-hmm.
No hiccups, nothing. I was like, this is it now. Mm-hmm. We're flying it.
Yeah. And at this point, were you still 3 weekly Herceptin producing after you're having your treatment? Yeah.
But I was in there's a few different classrooms of ASD in our school, and I was in the younger one, so they finished at 2.
Okay.
And I was like, very lucky, because Castlereagh is like 50 minutes from Castlebar and we're 40 minutes from Castlebar here. So I used to just leave at 2 that day, one day every 3 weeks, and drive from Castlereagh to Castlebar. And everything was great.
Everything was good, yeah.
Yeah. And then the 19th of February that year, 2019, Ed proposed to me. Brilliant. So that was a really good year.
Yeah.
Where did he propose?
So he used to spend all his summers in Achill with his granny and his granddad.
That's beautiful.
He loved Achill.
Yeah.
And we had gone on one of our first dates to Achill, down to Keene Beach. And this particular weekend, I was like, right, because it was Valentine's Day. We had missed the Valentine's Day during the week. Yeah. So we said we'd go to Keene Beach for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I was just wearing tracksuit, wellies, hat. Yeah. I looked cat. I wasn't expecting it at all, because we were going to Paris like 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And everyone
was
like, you'd have to have your hair done.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. And then he got me on the hop.
Yeah.
Like, great.
But it was lovely because...
So unexpected.
So unexpected.
Yeah.
So unexpected.
Yeah.
And like, the picture is gas, and I love it, because I'm just head to toe, nothing matches.
Exactly,
nothing.
But you're just yourselves, like, just, in that moment, which is the perfect moment, isn't it? Yeah.
And your ring is absolutely beautiful.
Oh,
did he pick it, or did you? Or
He had a promise ring that day, which was beautiful, and I still have it.
Yeah.
And then we decided we'd go to Antwerp to get it made after school finished in June.
Lovely. Fab. Yeah.
So then we were making plans to go to Antwerp, was really excited. And then when we got to Antwerp, I was like having to go to the toilet the whole time. Like, it was nonstop. And then I was like, what is it? But I have to say, it's kind of a thing that runs in the family. We have very weak bladders or whatever. Like, we're always running to the toilet.
Yeah.
And even one of my nephews now, he's at it as well. And all his family are like, what's wrong with them? And we're all just,
you know. Yeah. He's one of us, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't take much heed, because that was something I'd always had all my life as well. And how was I to know?
Because
nobody ever really told me.
Yeah. Look out for these signs or anything.
They didn't
like
know
that,
whether it was going to happen or not.
Yeah.
So then I went to my new GP in Castlereagh, and I moved GPs just because of where I was living, not because of anything else. And they put me on Betmega, which helped, which really helped then for a while. And then I was like having issues with the bowel as well. So I ended up going down to Galway to the urologist there, and she picked it up then. So the reason I was having issues with my bladder and my bowel was because I had spinal cord compression. So they were pushing on the nerves that control your bladder and your bowel.
Meaning that there was progression in the spinal cord.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it had now, you know, it had stayed in the breast, liver and lungs, and then it went to the brain and then it went to the spinal cord. And then they explained to me the reason why that was because Herceptin and Pertuzumab were keeping the initial diagnosis asleep.
Yeah.
But it had now crossed the blood-brain barrier, yes. And they couldn't do, like, Herceptin and Pertuzumab weren't working on mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I imagine that was very scary.
Yeah, that was very scary. Mm. And at the time, I was in hospital getting more radiation to the spinal cord, getting the lesions on the spinal cord.
Mm.
And, like, one doctor did mention that paralysis might happen, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, I'll never be able to cope if I have to be in a wheelchair, you know?
Mm.
But, like, that happened at the start of the year and I had radiation, but then I returned to work again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're incredible.
Yeah. So I had senior infants then.
Wow.
And just had the radiation and went back to school. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
do you think school, sorry, do you think the school had a big part, I suppose, in like keeping you positive and keeping you really strong?
100%. Yeah.
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 Mm.
Now, I wouldn't, at school, I'd be very, you know, I wouldn't be telling people my news or whatever, but obviously my principal, my vice principal knew.
Mm.
And people talk as well, like lots of parents knew. And, you know, everybody was lovely.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Good, as they should be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
And you mentioned that they said the Herceptin wasn't able to cross the blood-brain barrier. Yeah. So did they change your treatment at this point after the radiotherapy?
Not at that point. No. They were like, it's doing such a good job. Okay. The other thing, we'll just stay on this.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that brings us, like, that was 2019 and then school 2019-2020.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so up to before my wedding, you know, I had noticed my walk was getting worse.
Mm.
And then I had an appointment the week before my wedding. And I actually had these lovely Jimmy shoes.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't wear them on the day because my walk got so bad. And the day I bought them, they were perfect.
Mm.
And was there much in the time that you had bought them to when you were planning on wearing them?
We had gone to London for New Year's. Because, you know, New Year's isn't what it used to be. It's a funny kind of a night. Yeah. We're like, we'll just get away for it.
Yeah.
And I had bought them in Harrods.
Fabulous.
Yeah. And they got them at such a good price. And they were different to any other Jimmy shoes I've ever seen. Yeah. They were gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I had a radiology appointment the week before. And the radiologist, well, he's a right dolt as well. He's just lovely. He's like, look, they're probably gone out of fashion now at this stage. No, because I had bought them the Christmas before we were meant to get married.
Okay.
So this was a year and a half later.
Yeah.
So then we had to try and find wedding shoes a few days before the wedding. You stay positive.
Yeah.
Things will come.
Yeah.
So perfect shoes, perfect height, block heels. Perfect.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And do you still have the gym shoes?
I do. Yeah. They're in a box. I might give them to my niece.
Yeah.
One of my nieces. I have three nieces.
Oh gosh, who's going to be the lucky one?
Yeah.
And you got married in Kilrona Castle.
Yeah, got married in Cross Malina Church and my uncle John married us, dad's brothers.
Lovely, yeah.
And I'd be very close to him as well. Yeah. Like, he's a missionary priest usually.
Yeah.
He's actually back in Ireland at the moment. So I had visited him in Tanzania. And then actually that summer that I had the radiation to the brain, once I came round and wasn't cuckoo anymore, myself and my friend Michelle went to the Philippines, Overton, that time as well.
Oh, fab.
So even though I had problems and was on radiation, I still did everything I wanted to do. Yeah.
So important to be able to do those things.
And again, my oncologist, like everybody else, was like, how are you letting her go to the Philippines? And he was like, if she wants to go, let her go.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you had a ball, did you?
Lovely time.
That's brilliant.
And he obviously has a level of trust in you as well. As you said, you've got a really good relationship.
A great relationship. Yeah. He knows
it works about ways. Yeah.
He knows I'm very determined as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we got married in Cross Malina Church and we had the reception in Kilronan because Ed is from Castlereagh in Roscommon.
Gorgeous.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you could have 50 people with the...
50 people, yeah.
Yeah.
Which was very difficult, but yeah. It was nearly easier than having the 100. Because when you have the 100, that's when you start kind of insulting people.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it was really... small. Cutthroat, like, do you know what,
like, especially like in, I know country weddings are huge, huge. Yeah. Like in Dublin, it's a little bit easier, I think, because they're cutthroat up there anyway.
Yeah.
Do you know, but it's such a tradition, isn't it?
To have a massive wedding, like probably 300 people.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, as a celebration of everything we had got through and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was 50 and it was like, not asking anybody who lives outside the country, not asking the uncles, I'll just bring the four aunts.
Absolutely.
You know, my closest friends, like that we've been friends since junior infants.
Yeah.
I kept it to that.
Yeah.
So then I wasn't insulting other groups of friends and stuff. But it was fabulous and we had a lovely day.
And you looked absolutely beautiful. I'm looking at your photograph now. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It looked like you had a nice day as well.
Oh my God. It was the week. Shining. It was so hot. Like, I was like, oh my God, I prefer rain. Like, like nobody could cope. It was like a heat wave. And nobody could get fans.
We're not made for it.
No. Yeah. Putting the child of Prague back in the drawer. Yeah. Like,
exactly. Oh yeah, like one of my bridesmaids, my cousin Aoife, had to get a fan off her boyfriend at the time, his mother's workplace. Like you couldn't buy a fan anywhere. It was crazy.
It's just typical Ireland.
But then on the day, it actually cooled down a bit and it was lovely. And we had our pictures taken over at the lake.
Yeah.
And it was just
so gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Delighted. Fantastic. So you finished your radiation, I suppose, at that point for the on the spinal cord. You were on your Herceptin pertuzumab, so did you feel relatively well around that time?
Yeah, I did. I felt relatively well.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was July 2021, and I still wasn't allowed back to school because I was high risk.
Mm. Of course.
So I was teaching on Zoom lessons.
And did you find that difficult?
Well, obviously, I would have preferred to have been in school, but it was still nice to be part of the school. And, you know, I was, it worked out kind of well for them because they had an extra learning support teacher. So, you know, I was getting to work one-on-one with kids that needed
it.
And it was, I had a routine.
Yeah.
So I got up every morning, got ready, like I was going to work, you know.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah. And it was so uncertain with COVID at that time as well, wasn't it?
Oh,
it was
reassurance
to be at home and you knew you were safe as
It? Yeah. So 2021, we got married and then was teaching from home all that year. And then, it was the year before, they changed my
treatment
because they thought that if they put me on capecitabine and lapatinib, that it would be able to cover everything. And I was like, sure, this is great. This is brilliant.
They're tablets that you would have been taking every day.
Yeah. So I didn't, like, I still had to go up and get my bloods checked, but I wasn't there getting an infusion. So my hands, like, they were so bad. Like, I was off the drugs more than I was on them because I just couldn't tolerate it at all.
Yeah.
Like, every crease on my hands were all open sores.
Oh my goodness.
And my feet were the same, and Ed and I used to love going down to Enniscorn to go into the sea, like any time of the year.
Yeah,
January we'd be down there.
Yeah,
just loved it.
Yeah,
and I went in one day and, like, I had the little socks on or whatever, but I hit a rock and I had a blood blister, and Ed had to carry me out of the water, and it was awful bad. Like at that time, we went back to Castlereagh that day, and I was going around on Ed's office chair. I couldn't use my hands or my feet.
And so you had a hard time on that treatment. You had
very
really
hard,
bad side effects.
Yeah,
which must have been really difficult because with the other infusions, like you say, you have a quality of life. You can feel quite well. You went on holidays.
Yeah, and people used to say, oh, how are you coping with the treatment? I was like, I don't even notice it. You know, my hair grew back. I was a bit tired, but that was it.
That was it.
And then I went on this and I thought it would be great. but I just couldn't tolerate it.
Which we know is not uncommon. Like we were saying earlier on, you know, it's a difficult combination to try and get right, you know, and there can be a lot of chopping and changing. So there was probably a lot of that for a while, was there? Dose reductions and try it again and try this combination. And
take a break and go on it again.
Yeah, which is frustrating, isn't it?
So then, so this year, September 2022, I actually got back into school and I was absolutely thrilled. I was like, great, I'm back in school.
Yeah.
And my walk was really bad now at this stage.
Okay.
And I had said it to my principal and I was like, look, I'm not going to be able to teach PE. So someone else has to take my class.
Yeah.
Which worked out great because there's another fella in school who loves doing PE. And I used to take his class, which was an older class for Irish.
Yeah.
So it was great.
Mm.
And I was getting ready for school one morning, the end of October, start of November. And Ed was working from home that day. And I was bringing my glass of cranberry juice over to the table and the legs just went from underneath me. And Ed came running downstairs and the glass had splashed, like the glass had broken and there was like cranberry juice all over the floor. And he thought it was blood and he was, oh my God, he was in such a state. But he came in then and realised it was cranberry juice. So then I went and got more scans and they sent me to Galway Hospital. So I walked into Galway Hospital on crutches and I came out in a wheelchair. Which was very difficult.
Very difficult. Especially as you said earlier on, when you were going through the radiotherapy, if they said that you'll end up in a wheelchair, you wouldn't be able to cope.
Yes. So I found that hard.
Of course you did.
But November, December, January and February, I was in and out of hospital all those 4 months. So it's all a big kind of a haze to me.
Yeah.
And I was blue lighted from here up to Castlebar twice and so much happened. So like the radiation, like I lost the power in my legs and ended up in the wheelchair. But also we had to call the ambulance one day. I had this massive nosebleed. Then I was like, I am not going into hospital again. And I remember being in bed and I had the worst physical pain I ever had. It was on my back and it was like somebody, I can't even describe the pain. It was so bad. And I was like, I'm not going to hospital. No way. And then I was screaming with the pain and Mum came in and she was like, I'm ringing West Dock. And they said they'd send an ambulance and go straight up. And I had clots on my lungs. So I was in hospital for a long time after that. And then when I was in hospital, I also got the flu with strep A or B. Yeah. Anyway, the bad one.
Yeah.
It was way worse than COVID.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I mightn't have these in right order either because the whole thing is a haze to me. And then I came home and I was very, very weak after this. You know, when I came home first in the wheelchair, we had our own little routine and it was going good. But then I was just getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And then my bladder, like the treatment I'm on affects my bladder. So I wasn't able to go to number one. Like I wasn't able to go to the toilet. And then my bladder was like stretched so much that it got cuts on it or whatever. And I remember going down to the bathroom and my Auntie Pauline was here at the time. She's a nurse. And I was going to go to the toilet and then just blood everywhere. So then blue lighted up to Castlebar again and went to Galway that time. And I was in hospital for a long time. And when I came out of Castlebar or Galway, I had to go back to Castlebar. So it's all a bit over the place. So in that time, there was the radiation, the clots on the lungs and the cuts on the bladder. So then I was in hospital in Casper for a long time. And then after that, I went to the hospice, which sorted me right out because I have such a big appetite. I love eating healthy food, but I have a big appetite.
Yeah.
And by the time I was finished in Casper Hospital, like the last day I was there, I had half cup of tea and a quarter of a sliced toast. Just couldn't eat.
You'd been through so much.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, your body is just so...
And I was on steroids exhausted for 3 months that time.
Yeah.
But they didn't send me crazy that time. But it kind of like, I couldn't sleep. Like I hadn't slept in months. No. I didn't know what was going
on.
And then I wasn't even eating.
No. And a hospital's not conducive for a very long period of time like that either. No. You know, it's so disorientating because there's alarms going off 24/7. There's people coming in 24/7.
You're on a ward and there's, unfortunately, there's so many people, you know, with dementia and stuff like that. Yeah. It's very hard to see.
It can really affect your mental health. Yeah, and even leaving there and coming back home, trying to get into a normal routine is so difficult.
So difficult.
Having that respite in the middle of the hospice, like a stepping stone,
the hospice must have been like a godsend. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So nice to hear you talk about it, because it, people, when people hear the word hospice, they can get very frightened by the word hospice.
They think you go into the hospice and you're not coming out.
And it's just not the case.
That is not the case anymore. Yeah. And even when I talked to the old fellas up in hospice, you know, they would have thought that too, but they're like, it's not that. It's amazing because nurses actually get to be nurses there.
Absolutely.
They get to come in, have a little chat with you, do whatever they have to do. You know, it's just so lovely. And I was in the hospice in Castlebar and the head chef came down and he was like, right, tell me, because I'm vegan as well, which makes things awkward. He was like, tell me what you eat, tell me what you don't eat. And I don't eat tofu and I don't eat curry and I don't eat any fake meat, which is what usually people think vegans eat. So every day I was just getting meal after meal. Like, it was like a 5-star
amazing
restaurant.
Exactly what you deserve.
Amazing. Doing physio. They had a brilliant physio there. And I literally went in and I was rock bottom. I was so sick. And I came out. It had, like, I had got the nutrients I needed, sleep I needed, the physio I needed, and we came home. And while I was in the hospice, obviously mum and dad and Ed had a rest. And obviously you're allowed visitors any time of the day, so I had lots of visitors as well. But we came home and I was so much stronger. And then it was from there I started to build myself back up, which was only in March.
That's when we connected again, actually, wasn't it, when you were in the hospice? We're trying to get the mics in, but we weren't able to. Understandable.
Yeah.
I think it's so important what you said there about your parents and Ed being able to have a rest as well, because obviously it can be so difficult. Like, they just want to be there 100% for you. And I think we see it as well. Sometimes carers can totally neglect themselves in all of this. And it's so important for them to have that window.
Because, like, mum and dad are very active. Like, I'm so lucky to have parents that are so well. Like, they're in their 70s and it's unbelievable, like, how well they are.
So well.
Thank God. And then poor Ed, like, because he's so busy back studying and working and all that, you know, it's hard on him.
Of course it is.
Yeah, of course.
And at some point through all of this, you started a new drug. So I think you said you came off the capecitabine and the lapatinib, and there
I came off that, and then when I was in Galway, they started talking about the, well, I had heard it before because my oncologist had said to me, like, a year beforehand, he was like, there's this new trial that's happening and destiny might be your destiny. And it had always stuck with me because the trial was called Destiny, and it always stuck with me. I had just a great feeling about it.
And you closed your email with that to us, actually, and it really stuck out for us as well.
Maybe destiny is my new destiny.
Absolutely.
But so I started Destiny on New Year's Eve.
Wow.
So that
2022, was it?
2022.
Yeah.
And I've been on it since. And it's working great.
Great.
My scans are good. Everything is stable, you know. So I'm very happy with it. I've lost my hair again, but that's the only side effect. Like, I can see myself lasting on this a long time. Like,
much easier than the capecitabine and lapatinib combination.
It's like Herceptin and Pertuzumab.
Okay, that's
I'm
good
just
to hear.
Going around as normal.
Yeah, so it can give you a bit of energy to build yourself back up again, you said.
So now my focus is to get out of the wheelchair.
Absolutely.
And I suppose for people listening who might be in the same situation, the drug in Destiny is, we were trying to get the name earlier on, TDXD, or trastuzumab deruxtecan is the new drug. And I was saying to you, I'm working in clinical trials myself and we've seen amazing results from it. It's really exciting to see
it's
something
exciting
like this for people.
Even when I lost my hair, the nurses up in oncology were like, it's so new, we don't know what the side effects are and we don't know what's going to happen with this.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing about, especially in breast cancer, like there's so much research going on that there's new drugs that are coming out
all the time.
Yeah. Like, you know, we spoke to somebody from Sloan Kettering in New York, which is the big cancer center in New York. And he said, like, the conversation we're having today is going to be very, very different, even in a year, two years, 5 years time, which is really hopeful to think that there's constantly new things coming up. Like, you know, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Your focus is rehab now. Get yourself back to,
That's fantastic. And to get myself like as strong as I can be, you
brilliant
know? And we think positive and hopefully
there's no one more determined than you, I don't think,
on absolutely
I'm very determined.
I suppose one of the biggest things I get from you, you know, if somebody is listening at home and they maybe have something that they're not too sure, is it something there, or maybe I'm just imagining something, I suppose the biggest why am I tired the biggest thing is to go get yourself checked out, you know, and be persistent in listening to your body and really kind of pushing forward with what's going on for you, really.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're so welcome.
We really appreciate it.
I feel so honoured to be here and like being able to listen to your story. Like it is really such a privilege, and I want you to know that we do really feel that being here today. So thanks for trusting us to tell your story. And I know I've learned a lot from it genuinely, and I really hope we all, anyone that listens to it, I know people will learn a lot from it. So thank you so much.
Is there anything we've missed from the conversation at all that you'd like to include?
No, I don't think so. Just to be aware that, you know, it can be very, very silent.
Yeah.
But just to be tuned into your body and, you know, if you feel that there is something, I would just say go to A&E.
You're right. As you said, you had 3-4 times with the GPs.
And is there one thing that you think, you know, like we mentioned Ed and we mentioned the school, and like your positivity is like, is unbelievable, do you know, like, and nobody will be able to deny that. Is there anything that you think has just been in your line that has been your North Star the whole time that keeps you that positive, or do you think that's just your baseline, you're really naturally positive person?
Well, no, Ed and mum and dad, they're the three that are closest to me all the time, but things that keep me going, see, I always love going out,
having something to look forward to.
But like, having something to look forward to. I love going to weddings, love the fashion, love the hats. So, and there's so many of them. And just, I'd always have something to work towards.
I think that's really like important, because what we can see a lot is, you know, a lot of people can retreat back from doing the things that they used to do before, but actually you've done the opposite and
Went traveling.
Exactly. Yeah. Your story is so different.
Like Ed and I have gone on so many fabulous holidays since I've got sick. Doing all the things I always loved doing. And also like going for afternoon tea and nice things like that. Shopping.
And one thing I notice with a lot of people I speak to, obviously in our day to day job, you know, especially somebody like, you know, I relate to you a lot, being like, I'm just a busybody and we're running around all the time and you're so independent. You probably never really asked for help an awful lot before. So how did you find that now? Probably have to ask for a bit of help here and there.
It was kind of a gradual thing. Like, you know, like when COVID came, everyone was gone mad. But at that stage, I had been sick so many times that I was forced to go to bed and relax and sleep. And, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do that before. Because that would just be against, like, I always felt like I had to be doing something. But even, I'm still a little bit, but, you know, when COVID came, I was able to cope with it because I had been forced to
do it.
To do nothing before.
You seem like you've really leaned into your parents and Ed and got their support. And that seems to be such a, they seem to be such a strength in your story, which is amazing.
Absolutely.
So, I
wouldn't be, you know, as good as I am now if I didn't have them.
Yeah.
And so many people my age don't have parents, or they're not very well. You know, with the older age and stuff.
But I think everybody has somebody, you know, maybe it might not be their parents, but, you know, it could be in a cousin or a friend or something. It's just about leaning on them and asking them for help, isn't it?
I have so many friends and so many cousins.
Yeah.
And everyone has just been fantastic.
Yeah. It's easy to see why, because we can see the person that you are, exactly. You know? Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah. It's been a privilege. So nice. Yeah. It's gorgeous getting down to Mayo as well. This has just been
amazing. And we got to see the Enniscrone Beach that you spoke about. It's stunning. Yeah.
Stunning.
Yeah. Gorgeous. It's beautiful here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.